Not a nuclear reactor. Now, just for the curious out there that might find this interesting, just a little bit of interesting to me fact is, you know, everyone's familiar with the cosmic rays, alpha particles, beta particles. But beta particles are basically just high-velocity electrons. But alpha particles are helium-4 nucleuses. So you stop an alpha particle, sprinkle some electrons onto it, and you got a helium atom, just in case anyone is interested. So that's alpha particles. But, you know, I mean, there's a lot of radioactive decay that produces alpha particles. But, you know, you need zillions, making up numbers here. You need Googleplex of them because, you know, that's you know, a, you know, 4 grams of helium has 6 × 10²³ atoms of it. So you can imagine how many atoms are in a kilogram of helium. So just a bit of information for you people out there.
Well, glad Rose number. And thank you guys, that was great. And me too.
Yes, I particularly like Avogadro's number. I probably tell the story too often that when I was in high school, I did a research project on the electrolysis of water. Everything goes round and round. I used the electrolysis of water, the amount of current and voltage potential, and the amount of oxygen and hydrogen that was liberated in order to calculate Avogadro's number. The calculations, I think, took me the better part of 2 days. And when I went to college and got a password to our mainframe computer at NYU, I wrote a little program that put the formula into computer language, hit run, and about 2 seconds later, I got the same answer that it took me 2 days to get.
Excellent story. Thank you so much, NPTC.
Welcome. You're welcome. So Wesley, I agree that we got lots of helium, but we can always use more. You know, it's not a particularly renewable resource at this point. It would be nice someday if we can. You know, people have spent over 1,000 years in the secret art of turning lead to gold. They didn't really accomplish that with an atom smasher. You can make atoms of gold. The price per atom is kind of exorbitant, but you know, I guess we made alchemy work. It's just the details are in the devil's in the details. We're able to transmute metals into gold. It would cost probably $1 billion per gram to do it, though.
That's another interesting subject, neutron bombardment. That would actually make one species to convert itself to another species, but not all of the species are convertible, and not all of them are easily convertible. And beryllium. Well, the easiest one, I'm not sure if this is suitable for public. I mean, it's a public information. In a matter of 5 minutes, the neutron gun could be built. But no. Not going to go with it. It's very easy. It doesn't have to be done, anything done. And that is actually making non-isotopic species to go crazy and to XGN.
I'm a little confused. What is a non-isotopic thing?
Well, you have a steady atoms, and that I would call non-isotopic. The isotopes are, how to say it, although we have few steady isotopes, let's say unhappy atom. So let's say you, Dr. Roy, you are a very happy person. Let's say. I'm not sure, but let's say you're a happy person. And there is another guy next to you that is not very happy, and he's he's spitting out phrases or whatsoever, or pieces itself, because he's not stable. In the human species race, we use the psychologist and psychiatrist for it. But in the periodic table components, we cannot apply those techniques. So we can actually use that unstable form of isotopes for our own benefit. And that's how we can build the neutron gun. That's how we have the alpha particles. And alpha particles are used, have been used in every house smoke detectors. Enter Exia.
AC2GX. Okay. Isotopes is not exactly what you describe them as. An isotope is any form of an element with a particular number of neutrons, so it has a different atomic weight. A hydrogen atom has one proton and has a molecular weight, an atomic weight of one. Deuterium has a neutron and a proton, has an atomic weight of two. Tritium has two neutrons and one proton, atomic weight of three. Now, tritium is not a stable isotope and will decay regularly. Deuterium is quite stable and will remain for a long, 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 long time. You can mine deuterium in seawater. It's sitting around there waiting for you to take it. So there are stable isotopes. There are somewhat unstable isotopes. There are very unstable isotopes. This has to do with gluons and the binding force of nuclei, and neutrons tend to increase the binding. If we didn't have neutrons and you just had a bunch of protons, they wouldn't be able to stick together, which is why you will not see a nucleus without a neutron other than a sole proton in a hydrogen atom. Anything heavier than that has a neutron or two or three, and if you put too many, you destabilize it once again, and it can decay into something else. So isotopes do not really mean whether they're stable or unstable. They're just a characteristic. You can have stable isotopes. You can have unstable isotopes.
I can see that you came from the field of chemistry, not particle physics. I'll mention two forms. Each of those forms of the same element contain equal number of protons, but different number of neutrons in their nuclei, and hence differ in relative atomic mass, but not in chemical properties. So in particular, a radioactive form of an element. When I was using the analogy for unhappy atom, nature likes balance. So we have an atom that has equal number of protons and neutrons, does have a certain number of electrons around. But then we have the same atom of the same periodic table component that is not happy. It does not have an equal number. So isotopes are two or more types of atoms that have the same atomic number of protons and nuclei. That's what I'm repeating again. And the position in periodic table belongs to the same element. And they differ in nuclear numbers, mass numbers, due to the different numbers of neutrons in their nuclei. So, while all isotopes of given elements have almost the same chemical properties, they have a different atomic masses and physical properties. At which point I was wrong. Enter Exia.
Well, for those listening out there, I just want to add that it's a little bit more complicated than a nucleus wants an equal number of protons and neutrons. So you'll find cases where the most stable isotope is not a one-for-one correlation. So, you know, keep that in mind. It's a little complicated. And I generally try not to anthropomorphize non-human things. So rather than nuclei liking or disliking, it's simply that the binding energy is that you get energy released from a change in binding energy when an unstable nucleus decays into a more stable nucleus. And, everything seeks its lowest energy level. That's more physics-y than, you know, whether they're happy or not.
Well, I wanted to point that they're unhappy. So let's say I'm going to go just with one direction. Isotope can be defined as a variance of chemical elements that possess the same number of protons and electrons, but have a different number of neutrons. So in other words, isotopes are variants of elements that differ in their nuclear numbers due to the difference in total number of neutrons in that respective nuclei. So for example, we have a carbon 14, carbon 13, and carbon 12. They are all isotopes of carbon. Carbon 14 has 8 neutrons, 13 7, carbon 12 has 6 neutrons. So isotopes are primarily represented in two ways, by writing the name of the element followed by hyphen and the mass of numbers of isotopes. For the example, uranium-235 and uranium-239 are the two different isotopes in element uranium. So that notation that is being called AZE notation is specially done just because we need it. Because if we have an isotope, active isotope, that is, it has uneven number of neutrons, then we have this balance. Then this species wants to go to balance. So what it does, it reads out of protons. So we could have the positron radiation out of the nucleus, just and in high speed, and then the positron would be the antiparticle of the electron, having the same mass, having the same being actually the same, but being an electron, and because it's leaving the nucleus in a high speed, may not even destroy the electron on the orbit. But what may happen is it may destroy that electron, and that was used in medicine to help people, because when you have a collision of the positron with orbital electron, then both of them destroy itself, creating two photons spreading out at 180 degrees left right from each other. So we can build the map of your brain or your internal organs and see it just because of that factor. And to exit.
Well, Wesley, you kind of made a very circuitous route around the simple, relatively simple concept of isotope to matter-antimatter collisions and conservation of energy and momentum and other aspects in effect when a electron and an anti-electron or a positron annihilate each other, their energy is conserved and their momentum is conserved in two gamma rays going off in opposite directions, which is all well and good, but I don't know if it directly ties to the simpler concept of just atoms come in different weights and they're called isotopes. And so the atomic weight of an element is actually given as an average number of a series of the available isotopes found in nature. But I think we're going really down the rabbit hole, and it is 10:20, so it's probably a good time to introduce Paul. So if you want to wrap this up, please.
As always, you are very kind, Dr. Roy. I do appreciate that. Thank you for that. Yes, it is a time for Roy. What I was trying to say is that if we have a stable atom and we bombard that stable atom with homemade neutron gun, we can make it unstable. We can push it to become an isotope. But anyhow, thank you very much. Paul, it's your time. N2XGN.
Surely you're joking, Mr. Fineman.
Very apropos, Jeff. Anyway, thank you, Wesley. I just want to thank everyone who participated tonight. I hope you were either informed or entertained, or maybe even both, and that you'll come back next Sunday night when we'll try and do this all over again. And I appreciate all the questions. It would be nice if some people have some questions about amateur radio, but I'll try anything. Keep that in mind for next week. And now I think it would be a perfect time for Paul, WS2N, to bring us the SpaceNet report.
AC2GS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report, for the TechNet. Very good. Thanks, Roy. And I thought of a question earlier, but we'll wait until next week. If you hear anything about the antenna that has been installed on this repeater, it would be good to know the technical stuff behind it. You know, I just know a couple of rough ideas of what it is, but, you know, that's always interesting. Wes wanted to know about the frequencies above 20 gigahertz, and I'm sure he has this, of course, the band plan. I have it on the wall. You know, you start to go above 20 gigahertz, and you have 27 and 27.25, and then it goes to 47 to 47.22, and on it goes to 76. And that goes to 76, I think, 0.81, and it goes on and on, and it just keeps getting higher into the hundreds of gigs. So we have a lot of frequencies that at least I don't use, that's for sure. Let me drop it. Okay. By the way, Roy, how am I making it? You know, we're trying out the new antenna, and this is medium power. I'm sure this is okay, right?
Yeah, you're sounding fine. No problem at all.
Ah, just like the old days, like 6 months ago. Very good. And now we're back to where we were. And I think better. Very good signals tonight. Anyway, if you were, go to roy.ac2gs.com, his website. I put two pictures on, and they have to do with the space station that Jeff Bezos, of course, Amazon, but he owns Blue Origin, and he's got a proposal of a space station that he plans on building. So he's pouring money into this. He's got Sierra Nevada involved. That's another company that is building the Dream Chaser cargo plane, and eventually that Dream Chaser will eventually carry astronauts. He's also got Boeing involved with their Starliner, and his plan is to eventually launch these large modules into space, and then from those large modules he'll be able to tap off of it with other modules, either from himself or from other companies. But the two large ones he plans on launching with the New Glenn rocket that Blue Origin has been developing for years now that has not flown. The Dream Chaser has not flown to orbit yet, and they've tested it many times. Dropped it from a helicopter, make sure it could land properly on the ground. It's a small-looking space shuttle, maybe about 25% the size of the space shuttle. Will be able to carry up to 13,000 pounds of
cargo to and from the space station. And I mean from, they'll be able to bring cargo back and land it. Eventually when it becomes a crew vehicle, they'll be able to send up to 7 people into space on it. So that with the Starliner being built, that was almost ready, but they've had their problems over the last couple of years trying to get crews to go to the International Space Station. They were competing with SpaceX, with the Dragon vehicle that they've been sending up with the crew. They'll be actually sending a crew up very shortly, which will be the 5th crew flight for the Dragon vehicle. We drop it. Anyway, if this space station is ever built, it will be able to carry up to 10 people. The 2 pictures that I put up, it gives you a rough idea of what it would look like. And hopefully they do it. I mean, you know, the 3 main vehicles have not flown yet. The New Glenn, which is going to be a large rocket. I mean, it's almost as large as the Saturn V rocket, what that looked like. That would be, this will also be a liquid methane, liquid oxygen rocket, very similar to the same kind of gases that Elon Musk is using with the Starliner that he's building. And that's also liquid methane and liquid oxygen. And he has revamped, when I say he, Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin has revamped Launch Complex 36, which NASA has stopped using, and they've turned that one over to Blue Origin for its launches of New Glenn. So with, I think within the year anyway, probably within maybe 4 or 5 months, New Glenn should be ready for a test flight. They'll launch it unmanned in the beginning, but eventually it will be manned. And we'll be able to carry a large cargo into space. So, if you get a chance, you want to look at Roy's website, you could see what this thing looks like. It should be able to man 10 people as a crew. International Space Station right now has a permanent presence of 7 people on board. This will have 10. And apparently they're very serious with it. They've already poured money into the beginning of this project. We'll see what happens. They plan on having it done by the end of this decade. So this way we'll have a continuous presence in the United States of our space station. Space station probably will be, start to be retired by 2030. It's right now it's funded, I think, up until 2028. So we'll see if it gets a couple more years after that. Okay, on another note, you know, if you go back to amateurradio.tv, you can listen to old nets. This goes back all the way to 2006. Anyway, I was curious about something that we're doing in 2007, so I looked that up. And by the way, it's great to hear Dick K2RIW's voice. I think you can play any of the old Annettes, you could hear Dick. But if anybody that has come around after Dick is, you know, has passed away, you hear what this guy sounds like. He has a wealth of information. Really great to listen to. Anyway, we're talking about the space program. Of course, I was involved in that particular conversation. And we're talking about different upcoming missions that we're planning on going up. Talking about the longevity of the 2 rovers that were riding around on Mars at the time in 2007. Spirit and Opportunity, they were both launched in 2004. Talking about that. And I was talking about the upcoming mission. It didn't have a name at the time. It was going to be the rover. Eventually, it was called Curiosity, and that was launched in 2012. That prediction was coming up right in 2007. We were talking about 2012. That's what NASA stuck to, and sure enough, it was launched in 2012, still operating today on Mars. But one of the other notes I had made at the time in 2007, I was talking about the new space telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope that was being assembled at, you know, in that year. James Webb was conceived in, actually, in the 1990s, you know, after Hubble had gone up in 1990, you know, they needed another space telescope, so they had the name, the Next Generation Space Telescope. Eventually, it took on the name, the James Webb Space Telescope. And the prediction in 2007, oh, that thing's definitely going to be launched in 2013. Unlike Curiosity, which turned out to be right for 2012, 2013 was way off for James Webb Space Telescope. It turned out to be way over budget, all kinds of problems that they had to solve, and the years just kept flying by. I remember 2017 was going to be a popular year. In that 2007 recording that I was listening to, you could hear Dick talking about, he was a Hubble hugger. He used to refer to that quite a bit. And he was anxious to see the James Webb Space Telescope eventually put up. And even in 2017, the predicted date, that never happened. But sure enough, it will be going up this December 18th is the date. Here we are in 2021. The James Webb Space Telescope. So hopefully that goes. December 18th will be a day I'll be looking forward to see this thing launched from, actually from French Guiana down in South America. They have the Kourou launch facility down there, and that's where Ariane 5 rockets are launched. Ariane 5 rockets are made by the European Space Agency. European Space Agency has three types of rockets that they launch from that from Kourou, French Guiana. They have the smaller version for lighter payloads called the Vega rocket, soon to be the Vega C, a little upgraded version of that. That's a solid booster rocket system. And then they have the Soyuz. They buy the Soyuz rockets actually from Russia, and they reconfigure it. A rocket for their own design. So that would be their medium lift rocket that's also launched from French Guiana. Then they have the heavy lift rocket called the Ariane 5. Ariane 5, similar kind of design, what they tried to duplicate the shuttle system. They have a center tank filled with liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, the same as what the shuttle used. Then they have two strap-on boosters, and they're both solid boosters. Same idea that the shuttle had. They had one on the starboard side and one on the port side. And the difference is the shuttle had three RS-25 engines that were fed liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. This one has just one Vulcan engine and very reliable, these things. This Ariane 5 has launched almost 100 times, very successful. Had a couple of little problems at the beginning, but extremely reliable vehicle to launch the James Webb Space Telescope. You know, some of us here in the States, why in the world is this thing always, even back then planned on being launched on a European Space Agency rocket instead of an American rocket? Well, part of it is the expense. This is now over a $10 billion program, and the European Space Agency has no charge to NASA to launch this thing, which normally takes, $100 million, $300-400 million to launch something like this. Probably $500 million with the James Webb Space Telescope. So that cost is pushed over to European Space Agency. But what they get out of it is the science. It's an agreement between us, Canada, and, you know, and European Space Agency, which is they have like maybe 20 countries involved with them. But that's the deal. And that's why it will be going up December 18th. So looking forward to that. Too bad K2RIW is not around. He was anxious to see the pictures of what this is going to look like once it gets out to its Lagrange point, two location, L2 location. The moon is roughly a quarter of a million miles away from Earth. This will be four times further away, in Lagrange point two, roughly a million miles away, just short of that anyway, in what they call a halo orbit, and that will be its permanent position. The scope itself is the 21 foot dish, which, you know, three times larger than Hubble, will be facing out away from the sun, will be looking out in that direction. So as the year goes on, year after year, it will be looking at a completely different part of the universe. So we'll see how this thing does. It's going to be as big as a tennis court. First thing after launch, after December 18th, it will unfurl its solar panels, pick up power from the sun, and then as it progresses out to the L2 location, different things will happen. The sun shades will eventually start to open, start opening these mylar sheets, which, like I said, will be as big as a tennis court, create shade. This way, on the one side, you'll always have the sun, and then these five layers of mylar-type material will shade the opposite side down to, they'd like to get as cold as Kelvin, but they can't. They can probably get down to 4 degrees. But then they want to go as cold as possible, so they actually have let's call it a cryogenic type of system on board to even lower the temperature even more at the detector, focal point of this telescope. And this thing actually sees in infrared, and it also has a visual, you can see in the visual spectrum as well, but primarily in infrared. Hubble was able to go ultraviolet, visual, and near infrared, just a little bit into the infrared spectrum. This one will go deep into the infrared spectrum. And these 18 sections that we'll put together, and that will open up, and that will form this 21-foot diameter mirror. And it's quite an engineering job to have this, when it opens up, to line up perfectly, so it will be able to work as one. We'll see what happens. They put 20 years and over $10 million into this project. Anyway, before I move on, any questions or comments? This is WS2N, and I'm also going to drop it for a long period of time, just in case Echo Link people would like to get through.
K2LR.
I hear Kate, but I'm waiting for the repeater to drop. Sounds like it's coming through on Echo Link. You want to try again? AC2LR, WS2N.
I don't know why Echolink is misbehaving here. Once the gym's so far away, they can't repair anything if it goes wrong, right? I'm feeling scared about that. Is there any plan on what they're going to do if some kind of malfunction happens? This is ACQLR. Back to you.
WS2N from NV2T. Did you copy that question?
Yes, I did. I did. Thanks for. I heard the whole question, but I'm waiting for the repeater to cycle. So that's apparently, like Kay says, the repeater is Echo Link is acting up, actually creating an echo. I could hear the initial question, then I heard it again. That's really strange. But yeah, we got the question all about the James Webb Space Telescope being located at L2 and not being able to be maintained. Yeah, I know I've talked about this before. Yeah, there will never be a service mission, as far as I know, to ever go out to that location. Definitely not planned. And I guess I could start to see why over $10 billion has been spent on this. They really want to get this right. If something doesn't work, there's going to be 84 different pyrotechnic devices that will have to fire to release springs, have motors move, all kinds of things have to happen. This thing's all crunched up and inside of the fairing of on the top of the Ariane 5 rocket before it launches. So this thing all has to unfurl properly. Like, the first thing will be power. The solar panel will open up, and then they'll start after that. You know, start doing other things after that. And you know, communication antenna has to unfurl these gigantic mylar blankets have to come out properly. The telescope itself has to assemble itself in space. And yeah, okay, if something goes wrong, there is no plan to save it. And unfortunately, I think they would have a hard time raising another $10 billion from Congress for another one. But they'll try. And they would try. So I just hope it goes well. Let me drop it. We'll see what happens. You know, I mean, this thing will practically look back into the beginning of time. We'll have to see. We'll also be able to look at planets. You know, we know where different exoplanets are. And it will be able to look at it and possibly detect whether or not it has, you know, any kind of methane or oxygen. It'll be able to detect maybe atmospheres around different planets, you know, using its spectroscope system. Definitely going to have that capability. I think there's going to be a lot of discoveries made with James Webb. Let me turn it back to Kay. And if she has any comments further, if not, we'll continue on. AC2LR, WS2N. I guess not. Well, you know, I know Echo Link has a delay, but the delay really has gotten carried away tonight. Anyway, I'm sure you're still listening, Kay. They do have a docking ring installed on James Webb Space Telescope. In case somewhere in the far future they figure out a way to send maybe a robotic craft to fix something. The idea of sending something out to that distance and then bringing it back with a crew would take months. You know, just to get out to where it's going, James Webb will take about a month. And you say, well, why is it going to take a month? Why can't they just blast away and then get out to where they're going and turn it around and slow itself down and put itself into position? Because that would take a tremendous amount of fuel. So the idea is to launch from Earth at the proper speed, and it's going to take all the fuel that the Ariane 5 has, and its upper stage as well. The upper stage is also liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, to get it, you know, going over 25,000 miles per hour on the way to that location. And then it just coasts, and, you know, gravity is still pulling on it from Earth, so it's actually slowing it down. And after a while, it's going 20,000 miles per hour, and then it's slowing down even more, down to 15,000, and then eventually maybe down to 10,000, until you get down to almost zero. And then it's just going at the right speed, and then from there on, it's got thrusters, and it's going to keep itself in that one position. You know, that's the way it works. So, but to do that, you know, that slowing down process takes almost a month. So that means to launch a crew there, you have to launch in a small spacecraft. That's what we have now. You know, Orion spacecraft, we're going to be sending four people in a pretty tight spacecraft to the moon. But, you know, that will take, you know, maybe, say, 3 days. Maybe they'll dock with the Gateway Space Station, which will be a lot larger, a lot more roomy, and then eventually get into a transfer vehicle to transfer down to the moon. You know, that's okay. But, you know, to put these people in a spacecraft, and by the way, the spacecraft that they plan on using, the Orion spacecraft, is good to carry that crew of four for roughly 21 days. So as you can see, it would take a month to get out to L2 position. And, you know, maybe half a dozen days to fix whatever they needed to fix once they got there. And then maybe another month back. And now that's the other thing. You would need a real large rocket to actually get itself to come back to Earth. So this whole process would take 2 to 3 months. We don't have a vehicle even planned to do that. If anybody could do it, Elon Musk would probably do it with, you know, a couple of starships, put that together, and, you know, enough fuel, maybe you might have a shot. But what you could do is launch a vehicle to that location, robotics on it. You know, I mean, that was actually a thought when Hubble was in trouble. You know, what happened was 2003 came along, February, and we lost Columbia, the space shuttle. It burnt up, and we unfortunately lost seven astronauts. And after that, they said, well, you know, we had done four missions to service the Hubble Space Telescope over the years. And there was a lot of talk, well, we don't want to send a shuttle anymore out just out to space and not have a location where it could, you know, dock like the International Space Station. They just wanted to use the shuttle now for the International Space Station. No more trips like STS-107 was, which was a Columbia mission. We lost that. That never went to the International Space Station. That was just a science mission, just going around the Earth, not even the same inclination of the space station. And eventually that, you know, we lost Columbia. So they didn't want to gamble and send another servicing mission to the Hubble. You know, things were failing. Gyros were failing. Computers needed to be changed. Optics needed to be upgraded. And they had all kinds of astronauts who were volunteering to go. And there was a lot of Hubble huggers that wanted Congress to push for that mission. But the robotic experts were saying, well, let's just design a robot to do this. But, I don't know, 2004, 2005, our capabilities, I don't think, were there. And the scientists realized that some of the things that they wanted to do, I mean, the engineers were, you know, not really probable. Maybe, but maybe not. It's just not really doable. But here we are in 2021, and we have terrific robots. You know, I've seen them on 60 minutes dancing around. It's just incredible. Your dexterity is getting better. We have put robots on the International Space Station. They're getting better at what they're doing. So maybe it's possible where you could eventually someday put some kind of robotic system on a spacecraft and launch it out to L2 and maybe do some kind of repair or something that needed to be done. We'll see. Let's just hope this thing works out. They plan on 5 years. They're hoping for 10 right now. We'll see what happens. WS2N, any comments or questions? Okay, well, let me go back to the late 1990s anyway. At that time, they launched another space telescope called Chandra. Chandra's X-ray astrophysics facility, I think they call it. Anyway, they give the name Chandra, named it after American Indian scientist that was really into black holes and all. And they named it the Chandra Space Telescope, launched in 1999. It's been operating ever since. Station, go ahead. This is WS2N.
WS2N from NV2T. Just curious, you know, I worked on the Cassini pool back in the old days at JPL, and we had the pipe bomb nuclear reactor, you know, on there. I wonder if they still use any of that stuff or are planning on using any of that now or in the future. Back to you, sir.
Okay, again, call here is WS2N. My name is Paul. I didn't hear your name, and I missed your call. It sounded like you worked on Cassini. Is that what you said?
WS2N from Norway Victor to Tango. No vacation to take. Hi. Name is Jim, Julian India Mike. Yeah, back in those days we had the little pipe bomb reactor on there, you know. And I'm just wondering if they still use any of that technology today or are planning on using the, you know, unshielded reactor type thing.
Oh, okay, yeah, the RTGs, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators. Yeah, I know Cassini had it. Galileo had it. In fact, Apollo 12 had it. They brought it up with Apollo 12. Are they still using them today? The Horizon spacecraft, that is still going. I mean, that thing went out. It visited Pluto and its five moons. Kept on going and eventually went to another object in the Kuiper Belt and photographed that in detail, and they have plans of still using that, and that's still able to do its work because of the RTG on board. There's a limited well, I'm sure you know, there's a limited supply of the plutonium-238 that they use on it for RTGs, so they try to keep that to a minimum. We, of course, are presently using it on the rover, the Mars rover, the Perseverance, and that has one. You can see it sticking out of the back. It looks like it's angled, sticking out of the back. You see right next to the UHF antenna, the one that looks like a big coffee can. Got all the cooling tubes and everything all over it. You have to keep the temperature down. But, yeah, I mean, they still use them. And I'm trying to think if there's one plan to be launched in the future. Not thinking of any. I don't know of any that will be used on future launches. Back to you, Jim.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I'm trying to think how the, you know, how much power the Webb telescope needs, how the solar panels can afford to power that thing up, you know, for all the data transmission and everything. Kind of mind-boggling, you know.
Yeah, okay. You know, that panel, I used to know how big it was. But I think it's going to pick up a little over 3,000 watts. And they don't need that much because they constantly recharge their batteries. And it's constantly going to be looking at the sun, so it's never going into the shade. It's not like Hubble is in, you know, orbit. So I think it's 30 minutes that they lose for every orbit. So one-third of the time, this thing will always be looking at the sun. So they'll always have enough sun to recharge their batteries for James Webb Space Telescope. So they don't need an RTG on that. You know, now they're getting better with solar panels. Look at Juno, the one that's going around Jupiter right now. 100 net.
Time complete.
From one end to the other of solar panels. Three big panels, you know, sticking out of the spacecraft. Doing work that, you know, you really needed an RTG on Galileo in the 90s. But here we are. Now you have Juno going around Jupiter. Now you have Lucy on the way to the Jupiter orbit all the way out there with two 25-foot diameter solar panels. By the way, one of the solar panels didn't open all the way, but I think they're getting like 90% out of that, so it's no big loss. It didn't latch properly on Lucy. So they're able to do that, Jim, without the RTG. You said you worked on Cassini? That must have been pretty exciting for JPL. Back to you.
WS2N, NV2C, yeah. I was a contractor in the old days there. And I love working at JPL. It was amazing. I worked on the space station a little bit on the mapping of the Earth, you know, back in the STS 67, 68 days. But that was a high spot, you know. Yeah, those guys out there were amazing. That JPL team was just absolutely a collection of brilliant people, you know. And I only had a small part in it, but it was good working with them and seeing everything. WS2N, NV2T.
NV2T, very good, Jim. Yeah, you know, I worked in a lot of heating and air conditioning jobs, fire protection jobs. And, you know, if they sent me to either Grumman or Brookhaven Lab or something, that would be it. I would want to lock myself to the column and not leave, you know, just working around these people. It was great. So, yeah. JPL would be great. Another one that would be great would be in Maryland, Goddard Space Center. They're heavily involved with they're the ones that built Horizon that went out to Pluto, and they get involved with projects like that once in a while as well. Very good. Okay, any other questions or comments? I'm looking at the time. We usually start to close down around 11 o'clock. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Okay, nothing hard. Well, we have a few other topics, but just looking forward to a launch anyway on the day after Election Day, November 3rd. It was supposed to be Halloween. It was supposed to be today. And that's a launch by SpaceX on Falcon 9 from Launch Complex 39A in Florida. And they'll be launching a crew of four up to the International Space Station. And the thing I like about this mission is all four people on board are hams, are amateur radio operators. So that's pretty good. We'll look forward to that launch. Usually I give out their call letters and everything, but I guess I could. But we'll see. They'll be replacing four other people, three of which those four that are coming back are hams. I always like to see ham radio operators making it out to the International Space Station. Any other comments? WS to us. Well, okay. Yeah, Raji Chari, he's going to be the commander. KI-5-LIU. Tom Marshbon, I think he's flown before. KE-5-HOC. And Kayla Barron, she comes out of Idaho. KI-5-LAL. And Matthias Moore, I think Matt will, he comes out of Germany. K-15-KF. H trains in with NASA in Johnson facility down in Texas. So that's why they, even though he's German, he winds up with a KI-5 call. They take their ham test down there when they show up. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Roy, AC2GS. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report. We'll be on tomorrow night. Tomorrow night is Club InfoNet, that'll be on this repeater. Not at 8 o'clock, but 8:30. That's always followed by George does the Flop and Shop, and that's always followed by Radio Newsline. Yeah, Radio Newsline, you can get online, but it's always more fun to listen. Listen to on ham radio. AC2GS, WS2N. Back to you, Ron.
Okay, this is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net. Thank you for all that you do for the club. Also, my thanks to everyone in the technical committee for the repeater for fixing and replacing the antenna. I now no longer have to worry that my amplifier is going to burn something out. I'm running about 18 watts and loving it. So I thank everyone in that committee and the president and vice president and all the executive board of LIMAR. I also want to thank everyone who participated tonight. I had lots of fun. I hope you did it as well. And I hope that you'll join me next Sunday when we'll do it all over again at 8 p.m. Again, just want to remind you that if you want to reach me, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. The link page, which has lots of interesting stuff in it, is roy.ac2gs.com. And the stream of Glen Oaks is 24/7 for the most part, unless my computer crashes. And just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. That'll bring you the stream of the audio of the repeater. And Mike, KC2NJI, has a great amateurradio.tv website, which has the archives of the technical net here that go as far back as September of 2006. Let me drop for a sec. I don't want to time out too much. Anyway, as Dick, K2RIW, would often end his TechNet with something along the lines of be kind to each other, I agree entirely. It's good advice in general. It's particularly great advice right now. We live in troubled times. We live in all kinds of polarizing events. Please, don't make enemies. Make friends. Don't chat too much about politics or religion, all the usual things that upset people. Be safe, be well, be kind. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. And if you haven't been vaccinated yet and you can, please do. If you can get the booster, because every last one of you people, please tune in next Sunday night when we'll try and do this all over again. This is AC2GS, and I formally close the Halloween edition of the LIMAR Technical Net, and I am clear.
Okay, Roy, 70 piece from KC2TNT in Brooklyn, New York.
Hello, Ruben. I hope you enjoyed the show.
Yes, Roy, I was listening for a while. And, yes, I was doing a couple of odds and ends, but I was listening. This is KC2TNT, 73.
73, Ruben. Have a good week.
Good job, guys. NV2T, 73.
73s. Good night.
Thanks, Jim.
Tell you, Roy, you have a couple.